way, let's cultivate our motivation. And somehow miraculously, we're still in this life. We still have the conditions to practice the Dharma. So there's so many things that could have happened to have interfered with this possibility. But they didn't happen since last week, and so again we have this opportunity to listen and contemplate the Dharma. So let's really make good use of it. And let's really have a sense that because we have this unique opportunity, we have a responsibility to other sentient beings, especially all of those who made our opportunity possible in whatever small or large way. And so to really listen to the teachings with the wish to attain full enlightenment in order to benefit all beings most effectively, and really extend our heart out to others and rouse our effort and energy to be of benefit to them. Sometimes, while when we're practicing, we think that we have everything under control and that our practice is going pretty well and things are happening in a predictable way. And then something happens and our mind goes crazy. And I just received a letter from somebody recently. And this is what happened to her. And I think it's happened to a couple of people here too. You know, where you think you're making progress and then something in your life happens that you didn't expect. It wasn't on your calendar for that day. And it caught you off guard. And then you're going, whoa, what's this all about? And then when you're trying to figure it out, what you see is many sides of yourself that you didn't know were there, or that you knew were there but you were trying to pretend weren't there. And maybe anger or bitterness or resentment or jealousy, you know, things that we didn't think were so bad. And then something happens and wow, we're looking at a bunch of stuff inside of ourselves that we find totally disgusting. And yet, at the same time, one part of our mind is buying into it. Because we're feeling that emotion. You know, we're feeling the jealousy, we're feeling bitter, we're feeling whatever it is we're feeling. And one part of our mind says, I'm justified in feeling this. And another part of my mind is saying, I'm so miserable feeling this. And another part is saying, I thought I was making some progress on the path. How come this is happening? Poor me. Why doesn't it just all go away? Yeah. And so, has this happened to any of you? Yeah, you've seen things in yourself that, whoa, you know, just really nasty, ugly stuff. So when this happens, instead of getting whacked out about it, you know, to see that this is indicative of our having done some purification, because before we couldn't see this stuff. It was there, it was percolating under the surface, but we were ignoring it, but it was still having an effect. Because of the purification, now it's coming to a much more conscious or cognizant level, and so now we can actually deal with it. So instead of getting discouraged and saying, where did all this rubbish come from? Or why doesn't it go away? Or whatever it is. To say, oh good, now it's here. I can see it. I can work with it. I can integrate the knowledge that I have this side of me into, you know, my self-image without judging myself, without going berserky. And now that I see these things, I can start to actively do purification for them. Okay? So when stuff comes up, to greet it in that way. Because throughout our practice, this is going to keep happening. It's going to keep happening. Yeah? So really take it as a sign of making progress. Okay, so there's a few things here. So somebody wrote in and said that they feel that if they don't bear a grudge or have a negative view or anger towards a harmful action that was done to them, where they were the object of the harmful action, and that if instead they feel compassion and understanding for the other person's suffering, that then the negative karma has been diminished because the result has not been perceived as harm. So they're thinking that if they don't react as negatively, then the other person's negative karma isn't as severe. Okay, I think that's what they're saying. Okay. To what extent is this true when in fact great or small harm has been suffered before it was released by compassion? So maybe you feel harm, then you release it by compassion. I suppose our response cannot touch the karmic result from the motivation, but does it stop much of the negativity with a positive result? So we have two things happening here. We have the karma that the other person is creating, and then we have the karma that we're creating in response to the harm that's been done to us. Okay? In terms of the karma the other person's creating, like I was saying last week, that if somebody steals something from us, if we kind of give it to them, it doesn't make their karma of stealing quite as heavy if we're really giving it. If we're really wanting it back, then, you know, there's not much change there. Okay? But on the other hand, since most of the karma, you know, a good part of the karma is created by the force of the intention, and we have no control over the other person's intention, that, you know, whether we react with severe pain or with compassion, they're still putting the imprint of their intention in their own mind. So from that viewpoint, we're not lightening it or making it heavy. But from the viewpoint of, you know, maybe the damage that's being caused, if we don't take it so severely, then it's not as severe for them. But, you know, certainly we can't undo the force of their motivation, and that's going to come out loud and clear. You know, because otherwise it would be impossible to create negative karma in regards to bodhisattvas, because they don't have any harm towards us, and yet we sure manage to create negative karma in relationship to them, don't we? By the force of our own mind. Okay. Now, in terms of the karma we create, in terms of how we respond to their action, if we respond with compassion rather than bitterness or anger, resentment or rage, then we're certainly taming our mind and subduing the impact, you know, on our mind and not creating so much negative karma ourselves. Okay? And so this is really the key point here, because, you know, the things, when we have contact with certain objects, okay, feelings arise in us. Yeah, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral feelings. And then depending on how we respond to those feelings, that's going to influence the karma we create. If we respond with attachment, if we respond with anger, if we respond with numbing out, we're creating negative karma. If we respond to the feeling with wisdom and accept the feeling but without letting any kind of affliction arise in our mind, then that karma that caused that feeling just burns out and we're not creating any more. Okay? Are you getting what I'm saying? Yeah? So often we aren't aware of what our feelings are. And here by feelings I don't mean emotions. I mean whether we're experiencing a happy, unhappy, or neutral feeling. So part of mindfulness practice is to know when we're experiencing happiness, unhappiness, or neutral, or pleasure, painful, or neutral. There's different ways of phrasing it. And then when we're aware of that, you know, watch what our response is. And if our response is to tainted pleasure, you know, pleasure, let's say that's coming from sense pleasure, if our response, we're having a pleasant feeling, but we respond with attachment, then we're going down the wrong path. If we have a pleasant feeling and we respond by making offerings of the object mentally to the three jewels, or making offering of the feeling to, you know, may all sentient beings have this pleasant feeling, then we're not creating the karma of attachment. Similarly, if we have an unhappy feeling, an unpleasant feeling, if we get upset at it, yeah, then we're creating karma through our upset and our anger, or our hatred. But if we have an unpleasant feeling and we say this is the result of my own karma, there's no sense being reactive to it, then the whole thing stops right there. Okay? So this is a real key point, you know, to be aware of what we're feeling and to watch what our response is. Okay? You with me? Yeah. Okay. Then somebody wrote quite a long letter, which I won't read all of, but it was their reflections on Dharma joy. Okay, and I'll leave it out for you to read afterwards, but I wanted to read a few excerpts of it. Okay, so they're saying that, okay, I made the connection, I made the comment recently that when I was a young man, I always had this feeling that I was going to win the lottery and have a ton of money. I don't know why I felt that way, and I rarely even play the lottery. But it dawned on me recently that, in fact, I have already won the lottery in this life. The Buddhist teachings and having someone as skilled in transmitting the teachings to me every week is better than winning all the lotteries in the world combined. Isn't that Dharma joy? Okay? So that's, you know, the result of a very good meditation on precious human life, isn't it? Yeah. Okay. Then they were also saying that sometimes they do things that are negative or against the precepts. And he said, how do I feel when I do this? I can tell you in no uncertain terms that this is 180 degrees opposite of Dharma joy. Okay? So when you think of it, you know, when you've taken precepts, but then your mind gets overwhelmed by affliction and you do the opposite of it, then the feeling in your mind is 180 degrees opposite of Dharma joy, isn't it? Because we know we're in the process of creating suffering for ourselves. Okay. And then he says, every time I cut off some negative action that he's been doing, there is an immediate and very noticeable sense of an increase in personal power. Yeah, can you see this? That when you really make a strong decision and you say, I'm not going to do that again, or even if we look back in the past over things that we did that we enjoyed at the time we were doing them, but we see now that they were not very good, and we make a very strong determination that we don't want to do them again and we want to purify those things, then it's cutting off a negative, and right away you feel a sense of personal power, don't you? Because you're reversing the habitual tendencies to just flow downstream with the afflictions. Okay? So I often reflect about that because I notice that the things I have clung to the most that I really didn't want to give up were the things that provided the most fleeting pleasure and a very distinct and solid feeling of dissatisfaction. Interesting that the things he clings to, that the mind is most resistant to giving up, are the things that provide the most fleeting pleasure and a very distinct and solid feeling of dissatisfaction after you get them. Yeah? Isn't that interesting that the things that we cling on to the most, that we're attached to the most, are often the things that give us very little pleasure afterwards. Yeah? And a very strong feeling that I got that pleasure, but I'm really dissatisfied. Yeah? Anybody know that feeling? Yeah, we know it, don't we? Okay? The moment I finally made up my mind to stop, and I mean the moment, there was a huge swelling of Dharma joy. Okay, so the moment he makes up his mind to really stop that thing, then there's the feeling of personal power and the feeling of Dharma joy. Because we've set aside all that internal turmoil and all the dissatisfaction. From a realistic standpoint, I don't know that I am any better at meditating today than I was when I started 20 years ago. Wisdom and the emptiness teachings, I can't say that I have progressed on that front either. However, keeping much more ethical conduct than I used to and practicing generosity, those are real to me, and I can see and feel the progress. That's Dharma joy to me. Isn't that nice? You know, just the real things in your life that you can see that happen when you keep good ethical conduct, when the mind becomes more generous, really gives a sense of Dharma joy. Even if our meditation practice is, you know, kind of needs some improvement, even if emptiness is, you know, we can spell it and that's about it, you know. Still, there's a sense of Dharma joy that comes. Okay. So let's get back to the disadvantages of cyclic existence. Okay, so last week we talked about the first few of them. Okay. Which are... that things are uncertain. Okay, there's no certainty in samsara. Yeah, that we're always looking for security and we never find it. We are, aren't we? We're always looking for security. We want job security. We want relationship security. We want financial security. When do we ever have any of it? Impossible. Yeah? Impossible. Things are changing all the time. All the time. Okay? The second one is the disadvantages of dissatisfaction. So we talked about that last week, and we talked about it at Bodhisattva Breakfast Corner today. Okay? This pervading feeling of dissatisfaction. And, you know, why isn't everybody the way I want them to be? Okay? That mind is a function of attachment to our own expectations. Okay? We develop expectations, we develop ideas, we become very attached to them, that the world should operate according to how I think. And when it doesn't, we're dissatisfied and we blame the world. And so that's why our mind is always complaining. See that? Always complaining. There's this Yiddish word, it's kvetch. Okay, somebody's a real kvetch. It means they just complain all the time. So, that's what you hear from your parents. Stop being a kvetch. And you feel, but I have things to kvetch about. You should do this, and you should do that. And then they wind up to be right. You're kvetching. Okay, then the third disadvantage of cyclic existence, which is having to discard our body over and over again. In other words, having to die over and over again. The bodies assumed by each sentient being have to be discarded. If their bones did not rot, they would be greater than Mount Meru. So if all the beings, if all the bodies that we had assumed from beginningless time had not rotted and their bones still existed, those bones would be higher than Mount Meru. And Mount Meru is bigger than Mount Everest, okay? Mm-hmm. Mount Meru is the central mountain, okay? Center of the universe. The friendly letter says, the heap of each sentient being's bones would equal or even be greater than Mount Meru. So think about it. You know, just think about having taken so many bodies in a previous life. You know, okay, think of this body and then think of the bones and, you know, put them out in the room. And then next life, you live another life with all this, you know, disturbing things of cyclic existence. And then you have those bones left and you put them there. And how many lifetimes do you think it would take to fill this room with bones? Quite a few lifetimes, wouldn't it? You know, because if you think your bones, when they're just made into a heap, they aren't very big. You know, they're much smaller than our body mass in this room is very. And then you think, how much would it take to make a mountain out of bones? And how many bodies we've had in previous lives? And that each time, you know, we had to die and give up the body and go through the agony of death, go through the agony of separating from this body, separating from our ego identity, separating from everything around us. And how many times that we've done this? And, you know, zillions and millions of times. I mean, because even 1,000 bones, 1,000 lives, I don't think it would come anywhere near filling this room. Yeah? I mean, you think to make a mountain? Okay, and you get this feeling, you know, I've lived so many lives before. And to what purpose? Yeah, for what benefit? I've enjoyed things. I've liked my friends. I've hated my enemies. But for what purpose? You know? I haven't gotten anything out of it at the end, except just the repeated agony of dying again and again and again. When you think about it, then it feels like, enough already. Enough. When you live in Italy, there's this thing, it goes, basta finito. It's when you are totally fed up. Basta means enough, finito means finished. Basta finito. It's like, enough already, I am fed up. Okay? And that's the feeling you want to have about samsara, from having died so many times. Yeah. Okay, then the fourth disadvantage of samsara is entering the womb over and over again. So not only have we died repeatedly, countless times, the bones of all of our previous bodies can't even, you know, make a mountain, a huge mountain. But in addition, we've taken rebirth again and again and again, uncontrollably. Okay? And so the friendly letter says, the earth would be insufficient to count the number of one's mothers with pellets of soil the size of juniper berries. Okay, so if you have teeny-weeny juniper berries, okay, and if you try to count the number of lives that you've had, or the number of mothers that you've had in previous lives, by filling the mass of this planet with these little berries, it still wouldn't be the same number of times that each sentient being has been your mother. Actually, in the sutras, actually here it says, you know, the commentary to the friendly letter quotes a sutra, and I found the sutra in the Pali Canon. You know, unfortunately, I can't find these sutras in the Tibetan canon, because the Tibetan canon isn't translated into English. Yeah, and the Tibetans rely mostly on the Indian commentary, so sometimes it's hard to find out what sutra a quote is from. But, you know, many, at least some of the sutras in the Tibetan canon have similar counterparts in the Pali canon. And so I found this one about the juniper berries, you know, it was in the connected discourses. Yeah. Okay, so the Buddha says, oh monastics, if a person were to take pellets of the earth the size of juniper berries, saying, this is my mother, this is my mother's mother, and so forth, this is my mother's mother, mother, you know, as he casts them aside, oh monastics, the soil of this great earth would soon be exhausted, but the series of that person's mothers would not. So that's looking back in history, how many mothers that we've had, you know, just in terms of this body going back, we would never reach an end. Now, I don't know, maybe, what's his name? Darwin would say that, you know, at a certain point you come to an end or something like that. But if we look in terms of the continuity of our mind stream instead of the continuity of this physical body, never reaching an end to the number of mothers that we've had and to the number of times each sentient being has been our mother. And if we think like that, then how many births have we had? And how many times have we had to go through the process of being born? Yeah. Everybody says that birth is like so exciting and so nice, but actually in the scriptures, you're saying no. It's very hard. That's why they call it labor. Yeah, it's hard for the baby too. Yeah. They say that for the baby, it feels like they're being squeezed, because they're going through this very narrow passage. Yeah, and then they're completely confused, you know. You're going from one environment to another environment in not very long time, and you have no idea of what in the world's happening to you at all. You know, must be quite scary. Okay, then the fifth disadvantage. The disadvantage of continually changing from high to low. So this is the one of changing status, you know, because we always want high status, we don't want low status, and yet our status is always changing. We go up and down, up and down. And today, what? How do you say the name of the governor in Illinois? The one who was accused of selling Obama's seat. The Illinois Senate impeached him today. So he went from being top dog in Illinois to at the bottom of the ladder now, you know. And he's not only lost his job, but people don't respect him for what he's done. So here's a very good situation of somebody who was very tough. And then, you know, I mean, he did it by his own actions. Yeah, brought this upon himself. But even, you know, if it was his own actions this lifetime, sometimes it's things we've done in previous life. And then, you know, I was telling you before about this big German billionaire who killed himself because he made bad investments. And you know, and so fortune is constantly going up and down and up and down and up and down, you know. We see this. It's like the value of the dollar. You know? And it's like you look and, you know, what the big CEOs of some of the companies are doing, you know, with their huge bonuses, thinking that they will keep their status very up. It's only a matter of time before it all comes crashing. Yeah. It was very nice. Obama called them shameful. He said it's shameful what you people are doing, taking huge bonuses while the economy is bad and ordinary people are suffering. He spoke very strongly. I was so glad. You know, finally a president who says something, you know? Very nice. But, you know, you can see in this kind of thing that, you know, people are trying to secure their place on top and they're gonna crash. Okay, so the friendly letter says, having been Sakra is the one of the lords of the gods, the desire realm gods, having been Sakra, worthy of the world's veneration. One falls again to earth through the force of action, through the force of karma. So you might be born as this very famous god and enjoy it, but the karma runs out. Then you fall to earth and you're just ordinary Joe Blow, okay? Or having been a universal monarch, one again becomes a servant in cyclic existence. Universal monarch is said to be one who is like the monarch of the universe. Yeah, and but then, you know, the karma for that runs out, bang, you know. Shekhar Rinpoche had this great thing when they took him his previous life to the top of the Eiffel Tower. He got up there and then he said, and now the only way to go is down. It's like being in the God realms. Once you're up, the only way to go is down. Yeah. And it's the same with all the things that we're trying to find security and status and something in samsara. Yeah? Whatever we get, the only, you know, it's going to go down afterwards. So, like, what's the use of hanging on to it? What's the use of wanting to be born in samsara if this continues to happen? Having long experienced the pleasure of fondling the breasts and hips of celestial maidens, one undergoes the unbearable contact of the crushing, cutting, and slashing operations in the health. They should put that on the porno site when people log in, you know. Don't you think so? Think of how following the pleasure of the grounds, yielding at the touch of your feet, while dwelling long on Meru's peak, the unbearable suffering of the fire pit and the swamp of filth will strike again. Having frolicked in lovely, pleasant gardens, waited on by celestial maidens, again your arms and legs, ears and nose are cut in the forest of trees with leaves like swords. After resting in gently flowing streams on the golden lotuses with beautiful celestial maidens, again you fall into the unbearable caustic boiling water of the infernal fordless river. having attained the magnificent pleasure of celestial realms and even Brahma's bliss of detachment, again you undergo endless suffering. As kindling for the fires of the hell without respite, when you have attained the state of sun or moon, the light of your body illuminates the entire world. But on returning to darkness again, not even your outstretched hand can be seen. The transmission of discipline says, the end of all accumulations is exhaustion. The end of being high is to fall low. The end of meeting is separation. The end of life is death. True, isn't it? And that's not saying that is not being pessimistic. There's nothing pessimistic about it. It's just accurate. And the thing is, the more we accept the reality of the situation we're in, two things happen. First, when we encounter the separation or we encounter the fall, we aren't taken off guard as much because we know that this is the nature of samsara. We know it's been coming. Okay. Second thing is that by understanding this is the nature of samsara, we develop the very strong urge to be free from samsara. And that wish to be free, that determination to be free, that's the renunciation of suffering that is going to give us energy in our dharma practice. Yeah. That's the mind that's saying, basta, finito. Okay, I'm done with this. Then the sixth, the disadvantage of cyclic existence. The friendly letter says, as the disadvantages are like this, take up the lamplight. Oh, this next one is the disadvantages of having no companions. As the disadvantages are like this, take up the lamplight of the three kinds of merit, for you enter the infinite darkness where sun and moon cannot reach alone. Okay. Meaning that we experience suffering alone. Okay? Now, we think, oh, but when I'm suffering, all my friends are around me, and when I die, I want everybody around me. But having everybody around you, can it eliminate your suffering? Can any human being around you, no matter how much compassion they have for you, eliminate your suffering when you're dying or when you're ill or anything like that? No, they can't eliminate it. Yeah, they may say things that help you, but they can't take away your suffering. And when we die, does anybody else come with us? Even if they die at the same time as we do? No, we go into death all alone. Yeah. When we're reborn, even if we're reborn, you know, they just had a thing of octuplets. You're born with seven siblings. Are you really born together with others or are you born alone? You're facing the situation of being in that crowded womb all alone, even though you're crowded together with seven others. Yeah? Okay? So what it's saying is, that we may have, like, a lot of nice things around us, but when we undergo suffering, we undergo them alone. Yeah. And so our best friend, therefore, is the merit we've created. Because while other sentient beings can't come with us, the merit, the good karma we create, does come with us. Okay. And similarly, the way in which we've habituated our minds, that comes with us, you know, because we live moment to moment under the force of habituation. We're creatures of habit, you know, and at the time we die the way we live. And you can see how the way we respond when things happen in life, you know, we respond so habitually, don't we? Yeah? And then you think about it, wow, if you know the smallest thing happens on a daily basis and habitually I get bummed out by it, what's going to happen when I die and something big is happening? Yeah? And I'm undergoing that alone, and it doesn't matter how many other people are around cheering me on, I'm still the one who's responsible for what my mind is doing. So that really wakes us up, because we have to practice now to rehabituate ourselves to something else. Yeah, because it's that tendency that's going to be really important at the time of death. You know, so sometimes we envision this very romantic death. You know, in the death meditation, how we always, you know, make it romanticized. It's like we've completed everything we've wanted to do. Everything's settled. We've forgiven everybody we wanted to forgive, and they just had all the people who wronged us happen to have all come and asked our forgiveness. And, you know, we're there and it's very comfortable. We know exactly when we're going to die, and we're lying in the room, and everybody who loves us is all around looking at us with so much love and putting a wet cloth on our face and holding our hand and rubbing our feet and saying, I love you so much. Don't leave. I love you. I'm always going to love you. You know how we dream up these romantic death scenes? Don't we? Yeah? And then our teacher comes in floating and, you know, and says, you've been the best disciple I've ever had, the most remarkable one. You're going to be born in a pure land. Amitabha can't wait for you to get there. He has all the lotuses ready for you. You think it's going to happen like that? I don't think so. I don't think so. You know? So we go through things alone, and we go through things by the force of our karma and by the force of our habits. Yeah? And we can see right now when our mind gets all tangled up and stuck. Yeah? Can somebody else come in and pull you, make your mind change? They may be able to talk to you so you get a different perspective, and then you make your mind change. But we don't have push buttons. Boing! Oh, all my resentment's gone. Thank you for pushing that button. Not like that. Okay? Then, these six disadvantages can be abbreviated in 3 points. Okay, so the 3 points. Cyclic existence is unreliable, is one. Whatever pleasures are enjoyed in cyclic existence are ultimately unsatisfying, is two. And this has been so from beginningless time. Is three. So of the six that we just heard, which ones do you think go under the point of cyclic existence is unreliable? Which ones? The first one, that samsara is uncertain. Which one? Which one? The fifth one? You said the status is unreliable. We're going up and down. And? The satisfaction goes in the second one. What else? Obtaining a body. Okay? So the first can be explained in 4 ways. Obtaining a body is not to be relied on, since it has to be discarded again and again. Okay, so the one of being born again and again. Okay. We cannot rely on receiving help or harm since nothing is certain. So also the last one of going on alone. We cannot rely on finding prosperity because our position changes from high to low, which is number five. Oh, actually, the one I said before, we can't rely on help or harm since nothing is certain. That's the first one, isn't it? And then the fellowship of others cannot be relied on since we have to go unaccompanied. Okay. Then so those four go under the first three points, that the psychic existence is unreliable. Then the second one, whatever pleasures are enjoyed in psychic existence are ultimately unsatisfying. That's which one? Two, the second one. And this has been so for a beginningless time. Yeah, what about multiple rebirths? Yeah. Okay. Then the second point concerns the evident disadvantages of dissatisfaction. The third point indicates that because we have entered the womb over and over again, the origin of our series of births is untraceable. Okay? So we have these three points, okay? The first one is cyclic existence is unreliable. The second one is whatever pleasures are enjoyed are ultimately unsatisfying. And the third is that this has been so for beginningless time. If we go to the second one, okay, that whatever pleasures enjoyed in cyclic existence are ultimately unsatisfying, that's the second of the six. The third point, this has been so from beginningless time, is the one about being born again and again, which is number four. And then the other four all go into the first point, which is that cyclic existence is uncertain, unreliable. Okay? That got number three about being born, dying again and again, goes into the first one about things not being reliable.
Being born unreliable because you have to discard the
No, they have the third point is because we've entered the womb over and over again. Because the third one is this has been going on since beginningless time, so that's the one about being born again and again, and then dying again and again. Goes into uncertain. Although you'd think that it could also go into this one. Do the abbreviated contemplation in this way. So if you don't want to go through 6 points, go through 3 points like that. To develop courage, okay, the friendly letter says, become disgusted with cyclic existence, the source of so much suffering, not getting what you want, death, sickness, old age, and so on. And the author says, think about the 8 kinds of suffering explained above. Okay, you're going, what 8 sufferings? Okay, actually in that quote, it's abbreviating the 8 sufferings of human beings. Okay, so the 8 sufferings of human beings are not getting what you want, getting what you want and being disappointed, getting what you don't want, birth, aging, sickness, death, and then the 5 aggregates. Okay? So those are the 8 sufferings. Sometimes they tie them specifically to human beings. But I find it very helpful to meditate, especially on those initial, well, all of them actually, you know? Not getting what you want and how miserably we are because we don't get what we want. Then you get what you want and you're disappointed. That happens all the time too. Then we try so hard to avoid problems and they come. Lots of examples of that in our life. Then we get born, which we were talking about isn't so much fun. We get sick, not so much fun. We get old, and you can see how much we hate that by how many products there are on the market to try and prevent it. And then we die at the end of the whole thing. And then the basic thing is that we have these five aggregates under the control of afflictions and karma. That's the basic suffering. Okay. So remember, suffering here doesn't mean ouch. It means unsatisfactory condition. Because otherwise we think, oh, you know, people in Darfur are suffering, but people in Beverly Hills aren't. Okay? People in Beverly Hills are just as much in samsara as people in Darfur. And maybe in 20 years, the people who have been born in both places have completely flipped and changed places. Because that's what happens due to karma and our status being unreliable. You're in Darfur one life, you're in Beverly Hills the next, then you're back in Darfur, then you're born Israeli, then you're born Palestinian, then you're born Israeli, then you're born Palestinian. You know? You just keep going back and forth like that. So it's a really good thing for not being attached to anything in samsara when you think about this. Okay? So these meditations are quite important. You know, and they're very sobering for the mind. When we do them, the mind gets very sober. And at first, we might feel like, oh, this is, I want to be happy. You know, and this is like really sober. But the thing is, when your mind gets sober like that, at least I know from my side, when my mind is sober like that, actually, it becomes much more steady and even. And it doesn't go up and down emotionally so much. Because when my mind is sober like that, then the usual things it reacts to with attachment and upset, I realize are so stupid that I don't give them any energy. And so my mind actually remains much more steady. Yeah? And then the sobering effect really makes you kind of aware of what the situation is that we're in. And in that way, we don't get caught up in so much stuff. Because, you know, whenever we get caught up in our little samsaric dreams and our samsaric whirlwinds and our samsaric, I'm going to make this happen the way I want to make it happen, you know, and we get so caught up in that and how that always crashes at the end. Well, when we have this remembrance of the nature of cyclic existence, then we don't get involved in all those, you know, this kind of stuff, you know, our frenzied, stressful, hyperactive stuff. And instead we just stay really kind of balanced with what's happening. We become actually much more effective. It's true. I mean, if we look at it, what is it that makes us so ineffective in our life? Yeah, we're spinning so much, and our moods are up and down, and up and down, up and down, up and down. You know, I want this, I want that, do this, do that, I don't like this, I want that. And when you have an awareness, this is all samsara, you just ignore all that stuff, and you stay very steady. You do what you're going to do with a good motivation, and you become much more effective. You don't create nearly as much negative karma. And your sights are set on liberation. And so you have the motivation of the determination to be free or bodhicitta with you all the time. And so then you do a lot of purification by the force of your motivation and collect a lot of merit. In this way, think about the three sufferings in cyclic existence in general. What are the three kinds of dukkha? The dukkha of pain. The dukkha of pain. The dukkha of change. The dukkha of all pervading. Okay. And then the six sufferings, the six kinds of dukkha are uncertainty, dissatisfaction, dying again and again, being born again and again, yeah, your status going from high to low, and you go through samsara alone. Okay? So if you think about them from many angles, you will come to see the disadvantages of cyclic existence from a broad perspective. If you think about them intensely, you will develop a strong understanding. And if you think about them for a long time, you will develop a lasting understanding of the disadvantages of cyclic existence. When understanding the disadvantages of cyclic existence gives rise to a determination to be free, you should know that the precious awakening mind is the main supreme path to liberation from cyclic existence, and that this should form a part of the training in the awakening mind. Okay, so when you give rise to this firm determination to be free from samsara, then you should know that that renunciation or determination to be free is a major part of generating bodhicitta. Why? Because to have bodhicitta, which wants to free all sentient beings from suffering, you have to want yourself to be free of suffering, okay, or to be free of dukkha. In order to have compassion for others and their plight, we have to have compassion for ourselves and our plight. What is compassion for ourselves? It's not self-indulgence, self-pity. It's the determination to be free of cyclic existence. Okay? Lots of people come to Buddhism and say, I hear so much about compassion for others. What about compassion for me? I need to have compassion for myself. I'm so hard on myself. You want to have compassion for yourself? Generate the determination to be free of samsara. Because compassion is the wish to be free of, for sentient beings to be free of suffering, to be free of dukkha. Let's not even use the word suffering. Okay? It's the wish for sentient beings to be free of dukkha. What is the determination to be free? It's the wish for yourself to be free of dukkha. That's compassion for yourself. Okay? So compassion for ourselves isn't, oh, I'm such a sweetheart and the world treats me so bad. That's self-pity. Compassion and pity are very different. Okay? So the book is, our author here is saying that, you know, bodhicitta is very important, and to have bodhicitta, you know, a major supporting cause is this determination to be free. Yeah? And you see, lots of people don't want to think about the determination to be free because they think it's too sobering. But they like bodhicitta. But they don't really understand what bodhicitta is about. They can't. Because they can't understand what compassion is about. Because they don't have compassion for themselves, because they don't wish themselves to be free of samsara, because they don't understand what samsara is. Okay? Getting what I'm saying? Yeah, so it's really important. He says, this concludes the way to think about the preliminary teaching. So we've finished the first point, and we will begin the next point next time. Time for a couple of questions. We go over a little bit. Mm-hmm.
Mine's a question, it's a thought, but I've actually been thinking about this, the use of dukkha or suffering. Mm-hmm. And for me, as my practice has developed, mm-hmm. suffering is now much, much, much of a better word, because I have a much bigger picture of what it means. Mm-hmm. So it's just an interesting to observe the relationship with the very idea. Mm-hmm. So that in the beginning, I think dukkha or unsatisfactoriness was about all I could handle.
Mm-hmm.
But now suffering and change is suffering, suffering, suffering. That's just all there is to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's, anyway, it's just an interesting linguistic thing about mm-hmm. changes of practice.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you're saying as you've gotten used to the word suffering, it stopped meaning ouch and it's started meaning something else.
Yeah, and so it's very meaningful.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how do we deal with this amnesia? You know,
yeah.
That's the part. I mean, there are some moments in my practice that I I get this piece about how important meditation is, and then I have a really good day and something good happens, and I totally forget about any type of dissatisfactoriness I have in my mind. It's like my mind goes totally blank on any of the misfortune.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we deal with the amnesia?
Yeah. Okay, so how do we deal with the amnesia? Forgetting the fact that we're in samsara and this is a dire situation. Because you get it one moment and then the next day is kind of things are nice and you feel like a solid, inherently existent person that's in control. Yeah. So this is, you can really see the force of ignorance, can't you? You know? When we see this, when we get sometimes in our meditation a glimpse of what samsara is about, and then we see how 2 minutes later we totally forget it, we totally brush it aside, that is the meaning of ignorance. It's at that time that we begin to get some idea of what it means to be under the influence of ignorance. And that isn't even the root ignorance, you know? But that's the effect of ignorance. You know, we're just in a total cloud of amnesia. That for a moment we see what things are, and then totally, you know, we go to la-la land. And so this is why repeated meditation is necessary. Yeah. This is really why it's got to be through repeated meditation. So we complement it by doing purification, by creating merit, and by making request prayers to our teacher and to the Buddha. So those three things are quite important. They're part of the preliminary practices. And then we do the Lam Rim meditation and familiarize ourselves with it again and again. And then especially in the break time, as we're walking around, seeing things, training our mind to see them from a Dharma perspective. And I think this is part of the beauty of being in a retreat, is because we're not talking to each other so much, we have more time to look at things and remember to think about them from a different perspective. Whereas when we're constantly interacting with people, we get caught up in, you know, do they like me? Do I like them? And that, you know. And our mind gets taken away from trying to remember this bigger picture, even as we're going through the small things in our life. Okay.
May the spiritual
teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual masters be stable, and their divine actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Losong's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase. Dangara Ratna Mandala Kamiryataya Ni. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the enlightened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all such beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow. May the born of no decline but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain paradise, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrashi, may you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the ten directions, and especially at Travastia in the West, Lord.